The story that we are about to dive into this morning is set about 3,000 years ago, maybe even just a little more than that, in the region that we today call the Middle East. At that time, Israel was just a fledgling nation, and maybe that is even spoken a little too strongly, though Israel, Abraham's descendants, had been brought out of Egypt under Moses' leadership and been made a people, given an identity through their covenant with God at Mount Sinai. You remember, I will be your God, you will be my people. And though they had begun under Joshua's leadership then to occupy Canaan, the land that God had promised to give them, they are still really at this point just kind of a coalition, loose-knit of distant relatives. They are not at all organized as a people. They are not at all put in order as a nation, certainly not as we would think of today. There really isn't even any national leadership. The people of Israel are being led here and there in pockets throughout the territory on a more localized level by a series of kind of impromptu leaders that the Bible refers to as judges. Maybe you know the name, the book of Judges. Don't get confused by that label. These are not black-robed legal specialists holding a gavel, sitting behind a desk, folks who make decisions after hearing highly technical arguments offered by overpriced lawyers. Rather, these judges are local yokels, really. They're little more than hometown heroes who've generally gained their status as local or regional leaders, generally through a military victory of some sort over some neighboring tribe. These are people who, because the Spirit of the Lord rests on them for a season, are able to bring some level of stability and order to their local region, though usually for no longer than during their lifetime. So, here's the point of all that. All of this is within Israel a particularly unstable environment. Very much a fend for yourself proposition. Remember that Israel does not yet have a king. The coalescing of power that took place under King David and the years of prosperity that occurred under King Solomon, all of that is yet in the future. And by contrast to that kind of stability and growth, during the time we're talking about, Israel is much more marked by political disorder, and in fact, marked by some significant moral chaos. The Old Testament book of Judges describes the cultural climate like this. In those days, Israel had no king. Everyone did as they saw fit. Maybe even not, I don't know if this is a good illustration or not, but maybe not far from how we sometimes Americans picture the Old West. And it's in that historical context, the historical context we know something about because of the Old Testament book of Judges, that the scripture gives us a different book with a much more personal and beautiful story, the Old Testament book of Ruth. Over the next few weeks, we are going to be gleaning from this story. Good. Some of you saw what I did there. Good. Over the next few weeks, we'll be gleaning from this story and we will discover a wonderful chronicle of God's providential care, a rich expression of his love. I might even just tie this to what we've been talking about by saying a rich expression of the more abundant life that we've been talking about over the last several weeks, the provision and future that he gives to, of all people, a foreigner in Israel, a Moabite named Ruth. If you know the story, you know that it is really too complex and nuanced to tackle in one morning. Let me see if I can give you at least enough of the story to get us to a preaching point for today. The story opens with a man named Elimelech, his wife Naomi, their two sons, Mahlon and Chilion. They are from Bethlehem, and Bethlehem and the region around it is suffering from famine, something not particularly uncommon. You'll remember that it was famine in Canaan that led Jacob and his descendants into Egypt just a few centuries earlier. Well, this is what Elimelech does with his family. He relocates them as well to a better spot, except that he heads west across the Jordan River into the land of Moab. It is probably worth noting that the Israelites and the Moabites didn't have the best relationship. It was Moabite women, for example, who led some Israelites astray into the worship of false gods during the Exodus. That's pretty significant. It was the Moabite king, Balak, who hired Balaam to try to curse the Israelites as they were making their way towards Canaan. So the whole relationship between the two countries is historically a bit spotty. But hungry people take significant risks, and that's what Elimelech does as he takes his wife and his two sons into Moab. The Bible doesn't give us a lot of details or a very clear timeline, but sometime after they arrive in Moab, Elimelech passes away. We know that his two sons marry Moabite women, but then they, these two sons, pass away. So Naomi, this widow, is in a tough spot. She's an Israelite widow in a foreign land with no support system or relational connections other than these two Moabite daughter-in-laws. And just think about that for a minute. At best, Naomi, with her two sons still alive, was probably still only surviving on a day-to-day basis anyway. She is a refugee due to famine. And I assure you that I haven't chosen this text in order to make some political point, but thinking about current events and the status of refugees does give us some appreciation for what Naomi is up against. Now, she doesn't even have her sons. She is a woman in a completely patriarchal, man-driven culture. She's a foreigner in a land with which her country of origin has had a history of conflict. We don't know her age. Women don't often tell their age. But she is clearly older rather than younger. She has suffered the grief of losing her husband. And now she has suffered the grief of losing both her sons. And it is just difficult but kind of necessary to imagine how dark of a season this had to be for Naomi. She decides to return to her homeland of Israel. Please know that it's not like she could come back home and get on an assistance program or anything, but at least there, at least in Israel, she would be among her own people and she would be near some blood relatives. So she heads out toward the border of Israel and her home territory of Judah, where Bethlehem is located. And at least initially, as she begins the trip, her daughter-in-laws accompany her. It's my opinion, and just that maybe none of them knew for sure, you know, where all this was going, how all this would pan out exactly. But my imagining suggests that these daughter-in-laws at least needed to indicate, social custom would dictate, that they indicate they were willing to make this journey with her, whether they really were or not. It's kind of like when you transition to adulthood as a young person. Maybe you've got some financial independence, but that time comes when you go out to eat with your parents and you think you need to say, oh, I'll get my part of the meal, but everybody knows you're not gonna. Just saying. That's not a shot at anybody. Just saying. It was kind of their social obligation to indicate their willingness to make this trip. Naomi's daughter-in-laws, Orpah and Ruth, and you do know the little bit of trivia there, yes? Yes, six of us do. Oprah, the media mogul, Oprah Winfrey, right, is actually named Orpah after this daughter-in-law of Naomi. But people so consistently mispronounced Orpah as Oprah that the name stuck, and she stuck with it. True story. You can check it out on Wikipedia. Always trustworthy, right? So Naomi's daughter-in-laws, Orpah and Ruth, begin the journey with her, and after they've walked some distance, maybe it was just to the city gate, or maybe it was a couple of miles down the path, or however far they went, Naomi turns to them, Ruth chapter 1, and says to them, go back, right? Here's Naomi. She's a widow, she's broke, she's grieving, she's lost, she's heading back to her homeland, and she says to them, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness as you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. And then she kissed them goodbye and they wept aloud. And they said to her, we will go back with you to your people. I mean, it's quite a dramatic scene. Whether they meant it or not, I think is still yet a bit unclear, but they're certainly saying what they ought to say to their mother-in-law. No. We'll go with you. We're going to stick this out. And listen to what Naomi says next, because it matters for our study this morning. But Naomi said, Ruth chapter 1 verse 11, "Return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I am too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it is more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me." So with that last sentence, we certainly get some idea of the distress that Naomi is in. But let me give you an explanation that might help us understand what she says before she declares the bitterness of her life. She says to these younger women, "Why would you come to, with me? I'm not going to have any more children. I'm certainly not going to have any more sons. And even if I did, even if I got married today and got pregnant tonight and somehow miraculously, you know, had twin boys, and how many of you know that's not going to happen, right? But even if it did happen, even if it could possibly come to pass, would you wait for them to grow up to marrying age? Of course you wouldn't." So what Naomi is referencing here is a practice called levirate marriage. It is an ancient social practice. It's described in the Bible in Deuteronomy chapter 25, in which the brother of a deceased man, right, what she said, if I had more sons, you wouldn't wait for him to grow up, in which the brother of a deceased man is obliged to marry his brother's widow, and the widow is obliged to marry her deceased husband's brother. Think about your siblings and your in-laws, and everybody say with me, right? Right? I mean, pardon me while I go poke out my mind's eye, right? And that's what your relatives are thinking about you too, by the way, just so you know, all right? I mean, it's something pretty unthinkable for us, but please understand that in a cultural context where arranged marriages were the norm, and more than that, where especially for Israel, carrying on the family lineage was closely tied to continuing property ownership, property belonged to, and property was passed on to and through the family, not really so much as an individual as we think of property transactions today. In many ways, in that context, marriage was much more about building a social structure for producing and rearing healthy children, building a nation through stable families and population growth, than it was any kind of expression of romantic commitment. So again, however incomprehensible for us, if marriage is about society and children and property rights and legacy, instead of being about, you know, wow, she's hot, I sure feel good about myself when I'm with her, you can see where some process for making sure the family name endured would be important. It's more like marry this girl and get your life started and we'll figure out the love thing later. That's what's going on here. Part of Naomi's bitterness has to do with the fact that with the death of her husband and her sons, her family line is finished. There were just no conditions under which this passing on of the family name and the family property, something so important to her in her culture, there were no conditions under which she could see this getting accomplished. Therefore, there was no reason for Orpah and Ruth to accompany her. They needed to stay in their own land, she's saying, rebuild their own lives, and Naomi had every reason, it seems, to believe that the Lord's hand had turned against her. Well, they've already been weeping aloud, the Bible says, but at this, they wept aloud again. Can you just see the scene, right? Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. You want to know how to get a book of the Bible named after you? Show that kind of loyalty. Show that kind of tenacious loyalty. Ruth clung to her. "Look," said Naomi, "your sister-in-law is going back to her people and her gods. Go back with her." But Ruth replied, "Don't urge me to leave you or turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. And where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried." I mean, that's all pretty final, isn't it, right? "May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me." All right, that is a powerful statement of commitment. Having read it, maybe we'll talk about it a little more another day, but just for what it's worth right for the moment, understand that the Moabites were polytheists. They believed in multiple gods. They believed that gods tended to rule maybe over a certain geographic area or perhaps a certain domain of nature. So there might be a god of the hills and then a god of the valleys, and there might be a god who controlled the lightning and a different god who controlled the rain. And since Moabites worshiped primarily Chemosh, for Ruth to leave her homeland and commit to going with Naomi was for her a conversion experience. She is declaring a conversion of faith here. She is foregoing any loyalty to the Moabite god Chemosh and embracing the Israelite god Yahweh. "Your people will be my people and your God my God." It is a powerful declaration. And the Bible tells us that when Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her to stay behind. So, Ruth chapter 1, verse 19, "Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning." It's noteworthy when exactly they arrived in Bethlehem, because Israel's covenant with God made at Mount Sinai made significant provision for the poor when it came to harvest time. Field owners and their workers were instructed by the covenant that Israel had with God specifically not to harvest every last bit of grain in the field, but rather to be a little sloppy as they worked. And the poor then, after the landowner had gathered his harvest, the poor were permitted to work the fields and collect for themselves whatever remained. And it may not have been much, but it was enough to allow for survival of the poorest of the poor. Ruth is apparently aware of this provision in the law. Here it is, the beginning of barley harvest when they return to Bethlehem. So Ruth says to Naomi, "Let me go into the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." And Naomi agrees to that. So she, Ruth, went out, entered a field, began to glean behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she was working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. Everybody just say, "as it turned out." As it turned out. What a beautiful, subtle way to recognize the providence of God. You may know that word as a city in Rhode Island, right? Or maybe the title of a NBC television series. But before providence was either one of those things, it was a word and still is a word that describes the divine care and guidance that God so generously offers this world, often when we've neither asked for it nor are even aware of it. The casual greeting in a restaurant that down the road leads to a job or somehow develops into a lifetime friendship, or the inconvenient delay, you know, that delay that just had steam coming out of your ears because you were so ticked about it, that ultimately resulted in your avoiding getting collected up in an accident that happened on the highway. These things kind of evidence the providence of God, the careful watch care he keeps over his world and us as a part of it. And we may talk even about that more in weeks to come, but it is central to the story of Ruth, and one of the places it shows up is here. Ruth, the Moabite, ends up apparently with no direction from Naomi pointing her there. Ruth ends up, as it turned out, gleaning behind the harvesters in the field of a man belonging to a man named Boaz. And what do you know? Boaz was from the clan of Elimelech, the clan of Naomi's deceased husband. And what do you know? While Ruth is gleaning in the field, look who shows up. Boaz, the Lord be with you, he declares to his workers. And the Lord bless you, they answered, which is exactly how you greet other co-workers when you show up at the work in the morning. I know it is, right? You might try it. Let's just practice that real quick. The Lord be with you. Yeah, wouldn't that be a better way to start your day? Where's the coffee? No. Ruth, I mean, just wonder at this for a moment. Ruth happens into Boaz's field. Boaz happens to show up at that field. Boaz happens to notice Ruth. Boaz asked the overseers of his harvesters, who does that young woman belong to? Overseer replied, she is the Moabite who came back from Moab with Naomi. The overseer goes on to explain that Ruth had asked permission to glean after the harvesters and that she'd been there working all morning with only one brief rest, kind of a testimony to her dedication and devotion to the task. So much here that we're saving for another day, but though Ruth doesn't know Boaz, Boaz has heard of Ruth. He knows her story. He knows of her loyalty to Naomi. So he speaks with her, he assures her that she is welcome, and essentially says, look, you're safe in this field, you're safe among my workers, I've seen to that, make yourself at home, and skipping all sorts of important stuff here, let's jump ahead to verse 23. So Ruth stayed close to the women of Boaz to glean until the barley and wheat harvests were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. So this is working out, life goes on. Naomi and Ruth remain together as the harvest of barley and wheat continues. Ruth continues to work the fields, but Naomi understands that this setup can't go on forever, if for no other reason than that the harvest season and the provision that it supplied is coming to an end. And because she now knows, Naomi does, because she now knows that Ruth is working not just any field, but the fields of Boaz, her relative, Naomi gets an idea. Remember what we said a minute ago about levirate marriage. Boaz is a relative of Naomi's deceased husband, Elimelech. He's from the clan of Elimelech. That qualifies him as one who may be obligated under the rules of levirate marriage. Ruth is harvesting in Boaz's field. Naomi decides that Ruth needs to play that field. Ruth chapter 3. One day, Ruth's mother-in-law, Naomi, said to her, my daughter, I must find a home for you where you will be well provided for. Now, Boaz, with whose women you have worked, is a relative of ours. Tonight, he will be winnowing barley on the threshing floor. So they're wrapping up the harvest. It's really a time of great celebration. Wash, put on perfume, get dressed in your best clothes. Then go down to the threshing floor, but don't let him know you are there until he has finished eating and drinking. This woman is so wise. When he lies down, because Boaz would have slept at the place where the threshing had taken place in part to protect his harvest from thieves. When he lies down, note the place where he is lying, then go and uncover his feet and lie down. He will tell you what to do. So much I love about this scene and so much I don't understand. I mean, I love the coaching, right? Can you not just picture this Jewish mama coaching Ruth? Let's get you bathed and dressed, girl. We're going to put on the dog tonight, right? I'm sure that's exactly how she said it. And then I'm just going to tell you, I don't completely understand this uncover his feet and lie down bit. I mean, logistically, I just don't understand it. What is that supposed to make his feet cold so that he wakes up, or what's supposed to, I mean, that's what would happen to me. Don't be pulling the blankets off my feet in the middle of the night. Symbolically, I get it. I can see where that would be the sign of a submissive spirit on Ruth's part, to lie down at the feet of Boaz. And we haven't read this far yet, but when she does this very thing and Boaz awakens, he covers Ruth with the corner of his blanket. I get the symbolism of protection and provision that's provided there. But the specific logistics themselves, I'll just tell you that they're just a little bit lost on me, and remind you that that can happen with a 3,000-year-old social practice from another culture halfway across the globe. We might not quite understand exactly how all that worked. Regardless, Ruth does what Naomi asks. I kind of, you know, I love Pirates of the Caribbean, right? Curse of the Black Pearl. That's the best movie of them all out of the whole set, I think. As, a bit like Elizabeth Swann or Elizabeth Turner as she's pretending to be at that moment when she requests parley in the Pirates of the Caribbean. Ruth, it's a legal procedure, and Ruth approaches Boaz in the manner prescribed, but then Ruth goes one step further and in a really bold move asks Boaz to act. Naomi has said he'll tell you what to do. Ruth isn't going to wait for that. She's going to take some initiative. She's uncovered his feet. He awakens, and then she says to him, I am your servant, Ruth. He asks, what? It's dark, middle of the night. Something's going on with his blankets. What? I am your servant, Ruth. Spread the corner of your garment over me, since you are a kinsman redeemer of our family. Couple of things here. First, I did read one source that suggested that the garment with which Ruth seeks to be covered, we reference it sometimes as a blanket, but probably it was an overcoat or a skirt or a covering of some kind, that the corner, let me go back here, the garment with which Ruth asked to be covered, the corner or perhaps the hem of Boaz's garment, bore in Israel the emblem or rank of authority, much like in our culture, the stripes on the sleeve of a military officer would tell you who he is and speak of his authority or her authority, which does resonate with me. It explains why David would have cut the corner of the garment of Saul when he snuck into the cave and Saul wasn't there, but his garment was, or maybe why the woman with the issue of blood wanted to touch the hem, the corner of Jesus' garment and receive healing. So I joked a little bit about uncovered feet and all that, but if that's how that worked, if this was a symbol of authority, that would give us some insight into the significance of this request by Ruth. Second, this is where the Levirate law we spoke about comes into play. Ruth invokes it, like Elizabeth Swann. Parley! She requests action. This is where, in this really bold move, she invokes Boaz's moral obligation to come to her aid. Spread your garment over me, she says. And this is where I say, and I'm so glad my wife isn't here to hear me say this morning, would this not make a great Hallmark Channel movie? Would this not make a great Hallmark Channel? Not that I watch those, other than to make fun of them. I can tell you what's going to happen next, dear, right? But does it not, honestly, does it not have all the right elements? The tragic beginnings to this whole story and the coincidence where it is Ruth happens to first glean and the notice that Boaz takes of her and yet the distance he maintains, his careful attention to propriety in all this. And I know that I'm the guy who said that marriage for this culture was not marked by all the sentimental sappiness that is supposed to serve as the foundation for marriage in our world. But I confess there is a love story abloom here and it's pretty enjoyable to watch it unfold. One thing we learn is that part of the reason at least that Boaz had been so careful in his dealings with Ruth, he asks about her, he protects her, but he doesn't move it beyond that, is that he's significantly older than her. Awkward, right? But when she boldly says to him, take me in. Spread the corner of your garment over me. You are a kinsman redeemer of our family. You meet the requirements of levirate marriage. He says, God bless you. The Lord bless you, my daughter. Not a reference to relationship, but to her youth. Your kindness to approach me in this way is greater than that which you showed earlier. You've not run after younger men, whether rich or poor. And now, my daughter, don't be afraid. I will do for you all you ask. Finally, this Hallmark movie is coming to a happy conclusion. Right? She's expressed her heart's desire. He's expressed his heart's desire. He has assured her, I will do for you all you ask. Oh, ladies, wouldn't you like a man who would make that commitment? But wait, there's a problem. Plot twist. There's another man. Boaz has to say to Ruth, although it is true that I am a kinsman redeemer of our family, and again, a kinsman redeemer was a person with the opportunity and the obligation to act in this matter of levirate marriage. And remember that it had not just to do with marrying somebody, but with the continuation of a family line and with that family's continuing to own family land. It had to do with keeping the family farm in the family, really. So Boaz says, although it's true that I am a kinsman redeemer of our family, there is another who is more closely related than I. Stay here for the night, and in the morning, if he wants to do his duty as your kinsman redeemer, good. Let him redeem you. But if he is not willing, as surely as the Lord lives, I will do it. I will do it. Lie here until morning. Among kinsmen redeemers, there was a pecking order of sorts based on the proximity of your family connection. And there was another person ahead of Boaz who, again, remember that we said family lineage was tied to property rights. There was another person ahead of Boaz who essentially had kind of the right of first refusal in this property slash marriage deal. He was ahead of Boaz in line to claim Ruth and the property associated with her. Really, Naomi through Ruth. So Boaz pronounces that first thing in the morning, he will act. He'll deal with this and see if he can be the one to marry Ruth. And he does act promptly. The next morning, he's at the city gates. He's at the entrance to the city, which was the place where in Boaz's cultural context, all official business would take place. If you needed to run into somebody or meet somebody, you'd go to the city gates. And as they moved in and out of the city doing their work for the day, you'd have a chance to catch up with them. There at the city gates, Boaz sees the man who's ahead of him in line, so to speak, with regard to this levirate marriage thing. He flags him down. He finds 10 elders of the city to act as witnesses, which was more difficult than just finding a notary public, but apparently that's what's required. And he brings the matter before them all. In the presence of these 10 witnesses, he speaks to the guy who's before him in this matter of levirate marriage. And he says, Naomi, who has come back from Moab, is selling the piece of land that belonged to our relative Elimelech. I thought I should bring the matter to your attention and suggest that you buy it in the presence of these seated here and in the presence of the elders of my people. If you will redeem it, do so. But if you will not, tell me so I will know, for no one has the right to it except you, and I am next in line. And the guy responds to that, I will redeem it, he said. I will. That sounds like a deal to me. I could use some more property. What a dagger in the heart, right? Plot twist, Boaz has an ace up his sleeve. Then Boaz said, on the day you buy the land from Naomi, you also acquire Ruth the Moabite, the dead man's widow, in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property. Can you not hear the music in the background? Dun, 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 dun! Right? And somehow, with this news that securing the property also means marriage, the fellow is now suddenly unable to make the deal. It's quite possible, honestly, that this fellow's hesitation to act was legitimate. A person had to be operating from a position of significant strength in order to take on the obligations of the kinsman redeemer. And this fellow declares that he is unable to do so. He doesn't have the capacity. With this news that acquiring the property meant acquiring Ruth as a bride, the guardian redeemer said, then I cannot redeem it because I might endanger my own estate. You redeem it yourself. I cannot do it. Essentially, I don't have the capital for this deal. Now, something that might seem a little odd to us is about to happen. The author of Ruth clues us into its meaning. It says this, now in earlier times in Israel, for the redemption and transfer of property to become final, one party took off his sandal and gave it to the other. How many weird social customs can we run into in one book, right? Why would you do that? Listen, it's tied to an ancient practice of taking possession of property by walking on the soil that was being claimed. You'd claim the land as yours by trekking over it. Likewise, removing your sandal with which you'd walked over the land to claim as yours and handing that sandal over was a symbol expressing the legal transfer of the land. So the guardian redeemer, Ruth chapter 4, the guardian redeemer said to Boaz, buy it yourself. And he removed his sandal. Then Boaz announced to the elders and all the people, today you are witnesses that I have bought from Naomi all the property of Elimelech, Chilion, and Mahlon. He's making this official in the presence. This is like recording the deed. I have also acquired Ruth the Moabite, Mahlon's widow, as my wife in order to maintain the name of the dead with his property so that his name will not disappear from among his family or from his hometown. Today you are witnesses. Okay. So much to this story that we have skipped over, believe it or not, for all we've waded through, so much we'll talk about that follows. But with this transaction, the exchange of a sandal, and this is the thing I'm inviting you to think about as we begin to prepare our hearts for the time around the table of the Lord this morning. With this transaction, we have one of the most beautiful pictures in all of Scripture of what Jesus has done for us. Boaz is the kinsman redeemer of Ruth. And Ruth has all kinds of strikes against her. She's a woman. Put her in her patriarchal context. She's a woman. She's a widow. Again, in her context, that wouldn't have been a plus. Ruth is a foreigner. A foreigner from a land that didn't worship Yahweh, the one true God, a land that even had a spotty history with Israel as a nation. She is, apart from Boaz's kindness, utterly impoverished. In short, her condition was our condition apart from Christ. Her condition was our condition apart from Christ. What does Paul, the Apostle Paul, write about us and about our condition prior to learning of, prior to running to Christ? Remember, at that time you were separate from Christ, excluded from citizenship in Israel, foreigners to the covenants of the promise, without hope and without God in the world. Ruth's condition was our condition apart from Christ. But Boaz, and let me make this observation, Boaz, from a position of strength, from a position of full capacity to do so, Boaz steps into the role of kinsman redeemer. And having already acted so kindly toward Ruth, having in ways we haven't even taken time to talk about this morning, having already supplied for her and cared for her, even as Christ does for us before we even come to a full knowledge of him. When Ruth steps boldly toward him and says, I am your servant, spread the corner of your garment over me, Boaz does so willingly and immediately. I will do it, Boaz says. As has Christ. As has Jesus Christ, our kinsman redeemer. And when we were excluded from citizenship in Israel and foreigners to the covenants of the promise, when we were without hope and without God in the world, Jesus came to our rescue as our kinsman redeemer, purchased our redemption, made us his own. And can I tell you this morning that I'm especially just kind of delighted by the fact that it is a sandal that testifies to the transaction. So earthy, so physical, it's so tangible. It testifies thousands of years in advance. It testifies to the God who would become flesh in order to be our kinsman redeemer. The God who would wrap himself in flesh and bone, would wrap his earthly feet in sandals. Would sandals, John the Baptist would say, the straps of which I am unworthy to loose. Sandals like those he would loosen from the feet of his own disciples so that he might wash their feet and express the servanthood that he offers to us and the servanthood that we ought to display. Whoever would be the greatest among you, let him be the servant of all. Sandals, I don't have any reason to believe this isn't so. Sandals he would later wrap around nail-scarred feet, by which he purchased our redemption. It's a very real sense in which even a sandal can testify to the price paid for our redemption, just as it did in Boaz's redemption of Ruth. We have been bought with a price. I simply tell you this morning that when you read of Boaz and of Ruth and of his generosity towards her in this wonderful love story tucked away in a tumultuous time in Israel's history, when you read of Boaz and Ruth and of his generosity towards her, of his readiness for relationship with her, of his willingness to act redemptively toward her, all of it, all of what you read about the rich heart of Boaz, the able kinsman redeemer towards Ruth, all of it is multiplied 1,000 times over in Jesus' rich love for us and his readiness to welcome us as his. I will do it, Boaz said. So has Jesus. So has Jesus. I am inviting you not just to celebrate, but to take advantage of the rich invitation, the rich promise, the rich welcome into covenant that Jesus extends to us as we gather around the table of the Lord this morning. Thank you for sacred moments together, Lord. I want to take a minute to pray your blessing upon these elements we are about to partake of today. We need these moments to be all you want them to be, nothing more, nothing less. So as we renew this covenant expression with you, as we again celebrate the way you have purchased our lives, our relationship, may we know that everything we need is found in you. Forgiveness for sin, healing for our bodies, empowerment for Christ-like effective living, a hope for the future, a hope rooted in your return on that time when you will set everything right. All of it's right here, capsulized in these moments, the bread and the cup and all they represent. So God, just make this moment all you long for it to be. Give us receptive and responsive and supple hearts to listen to the voice of your Spirit and what you'd speak to us together as we partake. I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen. Amen.